This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next, we get reactions to this week's historic Supreme Court decisions. Lisa Loving will continue to speak with Peter Zuckerman of Oregon United for Marriage and Laughlin McDonald, director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. At 10 o'clock, it's Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints. A North American gets a tiny taste of what it's like to cross the new militarized border. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Daniel Schmitz, author of What a Plant Knows, a field guide to the senses.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at KBOO.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Hey, it's 9:03. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving. This is Political Perspectives, and I'm very happy and proud to tell you Supreme Court bolsters gay marriage with two major rulings. It's a beautiful day. I'm just saying that. Peter Zuckerman, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
How do you feel?
You know, this is an enormous victory. It is a joyous day for loving married couples and their families, and for equal justice under the law. You know, today is monumental. And I also feel like it really underscores the work that still needs to be done here in Oregon, that we have to continue our campaign to make marriage legal for all couples in Oregon, regardless of gender. And, you know, until it's legal for same-sex couples to marry in Oregon, federal relationship recognition will likely remain complicated, leaving Oregon's families in limbo. So we still have a lot to do, but this is an enormous victory, and it's a joyous day for loving married couples and their families.
Yeah, that was going to be my second question, Peter, is does this mean that you can get married to your sweetheart right now or not? But we have to make the law in Oregon, and then if you want to, you can marry your sweetheart. Is that right?
Yes. In Oregon, the only way to win the freedom to marry for all couples, regardless of gender, is through a vote of the people.
All right. And I want to touch that a little bit now. How many states have marriage equality? How many do you think are poised to maybe pass it now? What does this do to that state-by-state drive for marriage equality?
You know, there's been same-sex couples in 13 states, I believe, now have the freedom to marry, plus the District of Columbia. And, I mean, we have tremendous momentum. I mean, Washington, Maine, Rhode Island, Delaware, Minnesota have all recently extended the freedom to marry to, you know, every loving and committed couple. And as of a bunch of countries, you know, France, Uruguay, New Zealand, Brazil, you know, NBA center Jason Collins recently became the first active male professional athlete in a major North American sports team to publicly come out as gay. And poll after poll is showing a growing majority believe all loving and committed couples should have the freedom to marry. And, you know, in this ruling, brings us one step closer to winning the freedom to marry in Oregon. It's a tremendous momentum.
Right. And listeners, if you just tuned in, the Supreme Court today ruled that married same-sex couples are entitled to federal benefits. And by declining to decide a case from California, that's the Prop 8 case, effectively allowed same-sex marriages there, just to put this all on a bumper sticker and be crystal clear about it. And Peter, Oregon United for Marriage, like, so how are people connecting with Oregon United for Marriage, and what are you guys doing here on this local level?
We are building a broad coalition of, you know, people from all different kinds of backgrounds to win the freedom to marry in Oregon. The process involves will soon involve gathering 116,000 signatures to put the freedom to marry on the ballot in November 2014. And we're going to have a big announcement about about that later today. We're having a rally at Terry Schrunk Plaza at 5 p.m. Because of the Supreme Court decisions, but we're also going to have some big announcements about the campaign.
We want to hear the big announcements. Come on. Come on, Peter. We can't hear what they are.
I wish I could. You know, tomorrow, if you follow up on this, I'll get you even more information.
Okay. We're live on the phone with Peter Zuckerman. He's the press secretary for Oregon United for Marriage. Peter, can you talk a little bit about how this issue has evolved now? I mean, you're a community organizer. You're also a journalist. You know a few things. You've been to this rodeo a couple times. How hard has it been to get to this point? How did the movement evolve this far? Little history there.
You know, Oregon has faced more anti-gay measures than any other state in the United States. And it's really, I mean, our state, like our country, has really been on a journey. You know, the original Prop 8, I forget the number of the proposition, was one of, you know, 10 years ago almost, we defeated, you know, one of the biggest anti-gay ballot measures, and we've made tremendous progress. You know, the real key and what's happening is more and more people talk to their friends and family about why marriage matters. They're coming to realize that for us, for gay and lesbian couples, it's not so much a political issue. It's about love, commitment, and family. And it's through these conversations that people are coming to understand why marriage matters so much, how marriage, you know, strengthens families, and how it says we are family in a way that no other word does, and is a fundamental freedom that should not be denied to anyone. And, you know, the way I think about it is, you know, people are thinking about it in terms of the golden rule. And, you know, I believe in treating others as one would like to be treated. And that includes allowing all loving and committed couples to be able to marry each other, regardless of gender.
You know what? Also, in this moment, I want to invoke Bonnie Tinker. Bonnie Tinker, she passed away some few years ago. Bonnie Tinker, I think, is a person who was sort of a peace warrior who was really instrumental in some of these battles, and her mother as well. Bonnie Tinker, and I believe she was the founder of Love Makes a Family. There are so many people who have spent their lives on this struggle. And I want to open up the phone lines, people. It's like, I want to hear some celebratory messages on this. 503-231-8187. What do you think about what the Supreme Court just did with marriage equality? We would love to hear what you have to say. Can you, Peter, talk a little bit about the coalition of people and the organizers themselves who are instrumental and who've been working for so many years on this?
You know, this has been, what's happening now has been a culmination of decades of work in Oregon. I mean, it's the Oregon United for Marriage is a huge coalition of people. We've got labor, we've got faith. I would say faith in particular has been a major member of the coalition. We have nonprofit, we have advocacy, we have LGBT organizations, businesses, elected officials, political groups. I mean, it is a very broad group of people who are working to win the freedom to marry, and it's because it affects a huge broad group of people.
It's true. And folks, if you want to call us up, we're going to have Peter on the line for another 20 minutes. And then we're going to move on to voting rights because the Supreme Court's been busy. I mean, this is the last day of their session, so they've been throwing things down like stuff on a griddle. But people, if you want to give us a call, if you have questions about how this is going to work or any aspect of it, 503-231-8187. Peter, okay. This is huge. Marriage equality is huge. And now this whole crusade, this whole battle goes back to the state level where we try to empower all the states, all 50 states, to give people marriage equality. What are some of the other real throbbing issues now that we're also going to be looking at? Because I know that's what the right wing are thinking. This is a slippery slope. And what's next? Peter, what's the next issue? I mean, this was a watershed.
You know, even after we win, this is a watershed. Don't get me wrong. Marriage is a major issue, but it's not all there is in terms of our movement. Another area we're really working on is trans justice, expanding healthcare access to people who are transgender. A lot of people don't get basic healthcare just because of their gender, because they're transgender. And that's an area that needs a lot of work. There's bullying, there's children in school get bullied because of their sexual orientation or because of their perceived sexual orientation. So those will be areas that we need to work on more. Health is an issue. The smoking rate is much higher among LGBT people. And then racial justice. People of color are faced by sort of the double whammy of racism and of homophobia or transphobia or, you know, not fitting perceived gender norms. So there's a lot of work to be done with people who are LGBT, gay and lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and who are also people of color. So those are three areas I can think of that still involve a lot of work that needs to be done after we win the freedom to marry across the country.
Right. Peter, we have a clip from Paul Katami, one of the plaintiffs in the Proposition 18 case, who was speaking this morning outside the Supreme Court. And so we want to go to that clip. So hold on. We want to listen to Paul Katami, who is an incredible leader in the United States. Go ahead.
You know, today is a great day. We enter this building and we always see those words, equal justice under the law. And today, we're closer to that equality. We're lucky, and we know that the fight continues across this country. We cannot forget our LGBT brothers and sisters that are in states that still discriminate against them, and we will not allow it. We will continue the fight until all of us are equal. You know, Prop 8 did one thing. It really helped us turn anger into action. It led to the foundation, the American Foundation for Equal Rights. It led to this case and to today's victory as well. And we stand on the shoulders of so many people that came before us, people that risked their lives to stand up and be who they are. They gave us the legs to stand up on today. They gave us the momentum to run with and the voice to speak loudly and say proudly that we are gay. We are American, and we will not be treated like second-class citizens. So, although we celebrate today, we work to make sure that everyone like Jeff and I and Chris and Sandy, we just want to get married because it's the natural next step in our relationship. We want to join the institution of marriage not to take anything away, but to strengthen it and to live up to its ideals. So today is a good day. It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
Oh, yeah, it does make you want to cry. The Supreme Court this morning weighed in on the two massive cases that touch on marriage equality, and they made two decisions that are favorable for marriage equality. 5-4 vote extends federal benefits to same-sex spouses. So that was a close one. Paul Khatami, we just listened to him speaking outside the Supreme Court this morning. Peter Zuckerman, can you talk a little bit about how does this issue impact everyone? I mean, we're talking about marriage equality. Theoretically, we're talking about queer rights. But you know what, Peter? 10 years ago, when here in Multnomah County, our county chair, she and the Multnomah County, they actually legalized queer marriage for like 3 weeks. And I'm telling you, I'll never forget that time because everyone I saw all over town was smiling. Everyone felt buoyed by it. And anytime you drove past that Multnomah County building, there was a line all the way around the building of people with wonderful clothes on and with champagne and flowers and smiling and laughing and embracing each other. Peter, how does this impact people who are not going to get married?
You know, I mean, I think the ruling, it really highlights that the work that needs to be done in Oregon. You know, you can drive across the river and get married there, and you can't in Oregon. And it really highlights how we have to continue our campaign here to make marriage legal for all couples, regardless of gender. And I think, you know, and to also add to what you said, you know, there are gay and lesbian people everywhere in all walks of life and all, you know, all different ages, all different skin colors, all different ranges of abilities. You know, we're everywhere. And a lot of people don't realize this is going to impact your family until they find out that they have gay and lesbian family members and neighbors and such. So it's an issue that impacts everybody. And I think, you know, more and more people are coming to realize that as more and more people come out.
It cracks me up, too, because of, like, marriage is so square. Do you understand what I'm saying? You know, and now, if we can pass marriage equality in Oregon, like we already saw our friends do in Washington State, that's going to impact everybody's life, too. Do you have an analysis about the economic windfall that has for all the local small businesses that basically provide services to weddings? I mean, did we see something like that happen in Washington State, you know?
Yes, we have. There have been studies done. I don't know if the study's been done specifically for Washington State yet, but there have been studies done in on New York and in Massachusetts and such. And, you know, it has helped business quite a bit just because you get people coming in who can finally get married. And I'd also say it helps business is also in an intangible way, in that, you know, when your employees are less worried about things like getting health benefits or, you know, protecting their family and they just know that they're married, you can be more productive when you don't have to worry about those sort of things. So it's something that definitely has a business impact. And when we win the freedom to marry in Oregon, it will help local businesses here, both large and small.
It makes me wonder if there are small businesses that could emerge that really specialize in same-sex marriage ceremonies. It just, when you think about it, anyway, I'm so excited about Oregon having marriage equality, and I'm sure that we're poised to do that. Where are Peter Zuckerman, press secretary for Oregon United for Marriage? Can you just be really drilled down specific about where are we here in Oregon with our drive to? We have to get that on the ballot. Did we get it on the ballot? Is it going on the ballot? What are we doing? Where are we at with that?
Yeah, the only way for us to win the freedom to marry in Oregon is through a vote of the people. We've tried other routes, but ultimately this is the only route that is left to us. So we have to get it on the ballot, and we've started that process. It involves a long often legal process. The next step in the process is gathering 116,000 signatures to put it on the ballot. Once we do that, we will the campaign will really start in earnest, and people will vote on it in November of next year.
2014 then.
Yeah.
Peter, do you think it's going to be easier to get people to sign an initiative petition for Oregon marriage equality now that the Supreme Court has thumbs upped it, green lighted it?
Absolutely. I mean, momentum in a campaign makes a big difference. And, you know, it's hard to get more momentum than this. I mean, now I think the entire West Coast, except Oregon, has the freedom to marry. And you know, it's, and state after state is winning the freedom to marry. So it makes it a lot easier to win. And I think that people are really starting to have this conversation more and more with their neighbors and friends, and they're starting to see why marriage matters to, you know, all couples regardless of gender. And so the more people talk about it and the more people see why it matters, the easier it gets, and the easier it will be for us to gather the necessary petition signatures and to win for everybody.
And everybody, I think, is the word too. So, Peter, actually, I just did a real quick web search and I pulled up a CNN Money article about the research that you were just talking about regarding the economic boost. They call it the gay marriage windfall. Okay, and this is even from a year ago, but they're saying that couples spend $27,000 on average on a wedding. Oy, same-sex couples generally spend yet less, but people are looking at a $74 billion wedding industry if more couples get married, which is interesting. It is a mondo billion dollar thing. But what I really like about it too is that it's small businesses. So. Here it says there are 646,000 same-sex couples in the United States, but only about 50,000 had been married as of last year, according to the Williams Institute for Sexual Orientation, Law, and Public Policy at UCLA. I just love encouraging people to look up more information on their own, right? But especially young people, because I know there's a lot of young people that are looking at the future and thinking, God, this world is so messed up. I feel like today's activities are part of the potential for making the world a better place. And we do have a caller. We have Harry. Harry's back. Harry, what's going on with you? What do you think?
Well, there's going to be an issue that's going to show up pretty soon. I don't know if it's been told, but well, in Oregon, in the Department of Corrections, inmates are allowed to marry. So the Department of Corrections might have problems with a large amount of inmates marrying each other, and some of it could be forced marriages.
Wow, Harry, I hadn't thought of that. Thanks for calling, Harry.
Okay.
Peter, it is interesting, the things that we don't think a lot about. It hadn't occurred to me to sit around and think about people in the penitentiary getting married, although there's a part of me that thinks that's kind of adorable. I'm sure that there's a lot of issues. Peter, do you see other issues around marriage equality that are not what we, issues that surprise you that come up in places where marriage equality has been achieved? Any surprising issues there?
You know, I mean, This sounds sort of cheesy, but I think the thing that surprises me most is just how much of a difference it makes in the lives of families. You know, you have people who say, you know, I always wanted to be able to get to marry my partner, but now that I can, you know, oh my gosh, it just it's done so much for our family, and it marriage really strengthens family in a way that is, you know, when you say I do, you say a lot more than I do. And so, I mean, that always is just really, really surprises me. And also just the sense of relief that people have where they feel like, you know, people understand the seriousness of our relationship and, you know, that we are partners and that we are spouses, and it just how much it means to people.
The part that cracks me up about that, okay, and I'm just the queen of twisted logic, and I love things that are surprising about information and trends in society. Peter, here's a case where the queer community turned around and kind of ate the religious right's lunch in a way. The religious right, remember, they were all about marriage is this, everything's about marriage, and you know, bubbity-bubbity-ba. And here is our progressive brothers and sisters coming out and saying, yeah, marriage is important and we want it too. I just love that. I mean, it's a place where the two ends kind of came to meet, and one of those ends maybe doesn't like it that the other ends got that, but I just have to put that out. It's like for so many years in my youth, young people said, I don't want to get married because that's what the religious right wants us to do. But here's a case where progressive people said, you know what, actually I kind of am with the religious right on that, and we want that right. Can you just talk about that a little? Because it's controversial a little, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's a lot more, you know, originally there was sort of this concept of, well, do we really want marriage? And, you know, is that just
square?
You know, what does that mean to us? And,
yeah.
and that now people are coming to understand how much of a difference that makes. And also to add to what you were saying, you know, how traditional opponents, you know, a lot of them have come to our side now and come to support our cause. You know, we have lots of Republicans who now support the freedom to marry. We have tons of religious leaders. You know, in Oregon, religious leaders are leading the way. You know, one of our chief petitioners is a minister. You know, it's been this, people have really come to realize how much this matters and that marriage is an important issue for all loving and committed couples, and
mm-hmm.
that, you know, when it ultimately comes down to it, what marriage is about love and commitment. It's not, you know, people don't think about it in terms of politics. They think about it in terms of, I love my partner, I'm committed to my partner, and I want to get married.
That is what you just said. And we are starting to run out of show for this segment, but I do want to say it is interesting that the Supreme Court ruling actually is coming down to economics, right? Married same-sex couples entitled to federal benefits, right? And yet, that's the thing that is surprising to me, too, is in the end, you know, we're arguing over whether someone's allowed to be at the bedside or whether they're allowed to have, you know, do they have to pay those same inheritance taxes if they can't, you know, show that they were married. But really what it does come down to is Paul Katami crying as he's looking in the eyes of the man that he loves outside the Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we think about marriage, we think about, you know, people don't say, I want to marry for rights and benefits. People say, I want to marry because I love this person.
And it's a different than a civil commitment.
We want to grow old together, and it's a different kind of feeling. And you know, and who wants to deny somebody that, you know, I mean, I think for people who are straight, it's really, I mean, imagine if you couldn't marry the person you love. I mean, that's what it feels like in our situation.
We have Lachlan on the phone. Lachlan, what's going on?
Well, we're all trying to recover from the Shelby County decision.
Oh, okay, hold on a second. Lachlan McDonald, we are starting to move into the ACLU Voting Rights Project. Lachlan, you hold on a second, and Peter, we're going to say to you, thank you so much for being with us for this first half hour where we were talking about the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality. And Peter, tell us one more time, how do we plug into Oregon United for Marriage, that effort to do the signatures and get marriage equality on the Oregon ballot? Tell us one last time, how do we hook up with that and make it happen?
There's OregonUnitedForMarriage.org has all the information. And also today at 5 p.m. there is a rally at Terry Schrunk Plaza where we will be giving updates on the campaign and you can really connect on ways to help us win the freedom to marry in Oregon.
Awesome. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today, and our love to your sweetheart, too.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was great to be on.
You too. And this is Wednesday. This is not Wednesday Talk Radio. That's my show that I do on Wednesdays, the hour before this one. This is Political Perspectives, and we are trying to recap live on the big Supreme Court decisions this past week, the past couple of days. And we just spoke with Peter Zuckerman about marriage equality. Now we've got Lachlan McDonald from the ACLU Voting Rights Project. Lachlan, not such good news about the voting rights. Talk about what happened with that.
Well, it was a very disappointing decision. The court, by a bare majority, 5-4, invalidated the Section 5 coverage provision. Section 5 coverage extends to 9 states and 7 jurisdictions within states and requires them to pre-clear any voting changes that they want to implement by either making an administrative submission to the Department of Justice or by filing a lawsuit in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. And they can pursue both of those, but they have the burden of proving that the proposed change does not have a discriminatory purpose or effect. And the Supreme Court, in its opinion, struck down the coverage formula, which is based on low voter registration and turnout among age-eligible residents at the preceding presidential elections, and whether or not the jurisdiction used a test or device for voting. And the Supreme Court said that coverage formula was simply out of date.
There's a really significant backlash actually taking place on that voting decision that the Supreme Court made. But Lachlan, talk a little bit about the ACLU's piece of that, the ACLU Voting Rights Project. What do you guys do?
Well, the Voting Rights Project was established back in the mid-1960s, and I think one of the first cases that the ACLU got involved in was Reynolds versus Sims, which was the Supreme Court decision saying that one person, one vote applied to legislative redistricting. But since then, the Voting Rights Project has filed literally hundreds of lawsuits on behalf of African Americans in the South, and also beginning in the early 1980s, we filed a lot of lawsuits on behalf of American Indians in the West, and we've been involved in representing Alaskan Natives in Alaska. So we've been doing voting rights cases for a very long time all across the country. And in the Shelby County case, we represented defendant intervenors, which included the Alabama NAACP and one of its chief officers and several of its members. So we were involved in that litigation, and we find the decision of the Supreme Court striking down the coverage formula to be very disappointing.
Okay, and just to put this on a bumper sticker, listeners, yesterday the Supreme Court effectively struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, as Mr. McDonald said, by a 5-4 vote, freeing 9 states, mostly in the South, to change their election laws without advance federal approval. That's what we're talking about right now. And we're live on the phone with Lachlan McDonald, the director of the ACLU Southern Regional Office. And now, what city are you based in, Mr. McDonald?
Our office is in Atlanta.
Atlanta, all right.
Although part of the office is now in New York, so we're actually in two different places.
Now, it's interesting, Lachlan McDonald. I was on Twitter a couple days ago, and one of my favorite tweets is a woman I've never met, but she's from, I believe, Tennessee, and she goes to college, or she lives in Boston. She was active in the Boston Occupy, and that's how I sort of got aware of her. She was live tweeting this Senate vote in Texas that would have struck down all, basically closed every abortion clinic in Texas one way or another. And she was just talking about how the progressive community nationwide in the United States acts like the South doesn't exist, and that these issues, these deep issues in the Southern states, impact everyone. But people just look at the South and roll their eyes and go, oh God, it's the South. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of this Voting Rights Act 1965 in these southern states. Why does this matter for everyone?
Well, it had an enormous impact because it prohibited the use of tests or devices for voting, and that there had been earlier civil rights acts, but if you struck down some discriminatory voting act or provision, that nothing would keep a jurisdiction from enacting something to replace it. So one of the things that Section 5 was designed to do was to give federal oversight and require preclearance of any voting change, and the jurisdiction would have the burden of proving that the change did not have a discriminatory purpose or effect. And the Voting Rights Act has had an enormous positive impact in the South. We've seen an increase in black voter registration and office holding. We've seen an increase in black office holding, but blacks have been elected mainly from majority black districts because, as Congress concluded in 2005 and 2006 when it last extended Section 5, that racial polarization is still a fact of life in the covered jurisdictions, and there's no question that jurisdictions continue to try to enact discriminatory voting practices. So the fact that the coverage formula has been found to be unconstitutional is a real blow to minority voting rights. But let me just say one thing, that the court concluded, quote, voting discrimination still exists. No one doubts that, end quote. So that's what this court's majority concluded. And secondly, they did not strike down the preclearance provision itself, only the coverage formula. And I'll give you another short quote. We issue no holding on Section 5 itself, only on the coverage formula. Congress may draft another formula based on current conditions, end quote. So the court struck down the existing coverage formula because they said it was outdated and was based on, you know, decades-old data. But that does not preclude Congress from coming up with a new coverage formula. And I think that the overwhelming sentiment in the civil rights community is that Congress, in fact, do that.
Yeah, and this is a key point. So I just want to, listeners, we're live on the phone with Lachlan McDonald. He's the director of the ACLU Southern Regional Office based in Atlanta. He also just said there's an office in New York for that. And we're talking about what the Supreme Court did yesterday with the Voting Rights Act. I want to read the editorial in the New York Times about this. The conservative majority on the Roberts Court issued another damaging and intellectually dishonest ruling on Tuesday that eviscerated enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, in which Congress kept the promise of a vote for every citizen. But it did not rule on the constitutional validity of the idea that some places have such strong records of discrimination they must seek federal approval before they may change their voting rules. Instead, the 5-4 ruling usurped Congress's power and struck down the formula that it has repeatedly reauthorized to determine which states fall into that category. The Supreme Court invited Congress to rewrite the formula, which has a disingenuous ring. The justices know fully well that that lawmakers who failed to expand that formula in 2006 are extremely unlikely to do it now. And so the preclearance rule lies dormant. So that's pretty strong rule. That's pretty strong criticism from the New York Times, which is not considered to be a left-wing bastion of radicalism. Mr. McDonald, what do you think Congress is going to do now? It's just probably going to be sort of locked in its own deadlock situation.
Well, you know, when the Voting Rights Act was first passed, Section 5 was to last only 5 years. And then in 1970, Congress considered whether it should be extended and extended it for another 5 years. Then in 1975, Congress again considered whether to extend Section 5, and it did so this time until 1982. And then in 1982, it considered again whether it should extend Section 5, and extended it for 25 years. Then again, it considered the extension in 2005 and 2006, and extended it again for 25 years. And each time when it was enacted or extended, it was challenged as being unconstitutional. And each time, the Supreme Court upheld its constitutionality. And I think one has only to look at the record that Congress compiled in 2005 and 2006 to see that there was clearly a justification for the continuation of Section 5 in the covered jurisdictions. You know, Congress compiled 15,000 pages of legislative history, heard from some 80 to 85 witnesses, held 20 hearings, and concluded unanimously in the Senate, not a single dissenting vote, to extend Section 5, and overwhelmingly in the House, 390 to 33 votes. So this was, you know, the considered judgment of Congress based on an extensive legislative record that we still need Section 5, and a majority of the court simply ignored that, which I think was clearly in violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments, which by their terms provide Congress with the authority to implement those provisions by appropriate legislation. And the extension of Section 5 was, in the considered judgment of Congress, appropriate legislation, but the Supreme Court majority simply ignored that.
You know, also on the New York Times this morning, Richard L. Hazen's column, really super interesting, The Chief Justice's Long Game. It's literally about the long-term agenda of Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. And it doesn't praise him. The court pretends it's not striking down the act, but merely sending the law back to Congress for tweaking. It imagines that Congress forced its hand, and it fantasizes that voting discrimination in the South is a thing of the past. None of this is true. Lachlan McDonald, ACLU Voting Rights Project, people died to make the Voting Rights Act happen, right? Can you give us a history of, you know, how it even got to that point where it existed?
Well, yes. Lyndon Johnson, when he was president, announced his intention to sponsor comprehensive voting rights legislation. But the real catalyst for passage of the act was the violent confrontation between civil rights demonstrators and state troopers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, on March 7, 1965, which came to be known as Bloody Sunday. Congressman John Lewis was one of those who participated in that. And 8 days later, President Johnson addressed Congress in a nationwide audience, and he demanded passage of a new Voting Rights Act that would guarantee all Americans the equal right to vote. This time on this issue, he said, there must be no delay, no hesitation, and no compromise with our purpose. And Congress, to its credit, responded to the president's call in late summer by passing the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I think it was, without question, the most innovative and comprehensive civil rights law since Reconstruction. But despite that, a majority of this court, and despite the court having upheld the 65 enactment and every extension of Section 5, struck it down.
I'm going back to this column. It's in the New York Times on nytimes.com, Richard L. Hazen, The Chief Justice's Long Game. We just had a real celebratory segment about marriage equality, just like the first half hour of this show. But with the Supreme Court, we're seeing the thumbs up and the thumbs down. It's pretty fascinating. I mean, that's a pretty divided court. Well, that's a conservative majority, but I want to read this. In the Shelby decision, that's what we're talking about, the Voting Rights Act decision that was just handed down yesterday. In the Shelby decision, we see a somewhat more open version of a pattern that is characteristic of the Roberts Court, in which the conservative judges tee up major constitutional issues for dramatic reversal. First, the court wrecked campaign finance law in Citizens United. On Tuesday, it took away a crown jewel of the civil rights movement. And as we saw in Monday's Fisher case, affirmative action is next in line, even if the court wants to wait another year or two to pull the trigger. Imagine striking down affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act in the same week. Lachlan McDonald, ACLU Voting Rights Project, where are we in the continuum of civil rights in this issue? Do you see this as one stop in a spectrum of I'm going to say maybe judicial attacks on voting rights? Can you put this in a little more context for us?
Well, there's no question that this court is deeply divided. This recent opinion is evidence of that. But this is actually the second case challenging the constitutionality of Section 5. After 2006, it has made it to the Supreme Court. The first was a challenge to Section 5 brought by a municipal utility district in Austin, Texas, and They argued, number one, that they were entitled to bail out from Section 5. Section 5 does have a bailout provision. If you're no longer need to be covered and you're a good acting jurisdiction, you can bail out by showing that you haven't had a Section 5 violation or other violation within the past 10 years and that you've undertaken affirmative steps to ensure minority political participation. So this jurisdiction in Austin, Texas, said it was entitled to bail out, but if not, that Section 5 was unconstitutional. And the lower federal court said they were not entitled to bailout, which they were not, and that Section 5 was constitutional. The Supreme Court agreed to hear that case, and I listened to the oral argument. We represented intervenors in that case, by the way, but I listened to the oral argument, and I came away convinced that there were four votes to strike Section 5 down and four to uphold it, with Kennedy being the swing vote, and waited apprehensively. A couple of months later, the Supreme Court handed down its opinion, and it rewrote the bailout provision, ruling that the jurisdiction was entitled to bailout, and accordingly, it was not necessary to reach the constitutional claim. And I perhaps put too positive a spin on that there really weren't five votes to strike it down. Then, when we heard the oral argument in the Shelby County case, it was like deja vu, like a hearing the Austin, Texas arguments all over again with the court being divided. And I still remain hopeful that the court would find some way to avoid reaching the constitutional claim. And they could have done that by saying that Shelby County brought a facial challenge, and they could have rejected the facial challenge and leave open the possibility of a jurisdiction bringing an as-applied challenge. But that's not what they did. In the dividing opinion, they struck down the coverage formula.
All right. And we are live on the phone with Lachlan McDonald. We're talking about the Supreme Court's striking down of the key provision of the Voting Rights Act yesterday. Mr. McDonald is the director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. That's based in Atlanta, and they also have an office in New York. I want to go back really quickly to this commentary, this column I've been reading from the New York Times. The tone of the opinion is one of dutiful resignation. Gravely, the court must strike down an act of Congress. Chief Justice Roberts reminds us that the court could have struck down the act in a 2009 case, but it gave Congress another chance. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent mocks this posturing. Quote, "Hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the VRA. That's the Voting Rights Act. The court could have acted more narrowly, for example, by saying that Alabama's continued problems with minority voting rights justified the law's application to Shelby County, even if not elsewhere. As it did in Citizens United, the court took the broad path when the narrow path could have limited the court's damage." Mr. Lachlan, Mr. McDonald, how do we just trust the Supreme Court? It's like I look at them and I feel as though it's a wild card. It's like one of those little magic eight balls when I was a kid and it was filled with ink and you shake it up and you don't know what's going to come out. Where's the logic there? I mean, how do we perceive the role of the Supreme Court? Are they like political tools? You know, give us some context there. It's like I don't understand it all the time.
Well, the members of the court during the oral arguments have said some things that were very disturbing, that you couldn't trust Congress to implement the 14th and 15th Amendments. I mean, that's that's totally indefensible, because the amendments give Congress the authority to implement those provisions by appropriate legislation. And to say you can't trust Congress to do that means that the Supreme Court is usurping the very powers that were reserved to the Congress and to the people who elect them to office. So it's very disturbing the direction that the court is going in.
And I wanted to bring this back, Mr. McDonald, to the work that you do at the American Civil Liberties Union and the Voting Rights Project. So talk about some of the cases you have participated in around voting rights in the past few years. What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, we've been involved in all kinds of litigation, you know, literally hundreds of lawsuits. And well, one of the most recent things that we did was to file a Section 5 comment letter with the Department of Justice. Fulton County is the county in which Atlanta is situated, and it's the most populous county in the state. And the legislature recently enacted a redistricting plan for the county commission, which plainly has a retrogressive effect on minority voting strength. unnecessarily pack voters in some of the districts to minimize their influence in other districts. It unnecessarily paired black incumbents. It didn't pair any white incumbents. And it reduced the number of districts in which minority voters had had an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. Well, that's a change, and the county submitted it to the Department of Justice for preclearance under Section 5. Although the plan was enacted by the legislature, the county submitted it, and then several weeks later, the county submitted a comment letter urging the Department of Justice to object to it. And we filed our comment letter a week or so ago, and we pointed out why we were convinced that the plan should be objected to because it was retrogressive. But now that the coverage formula has been invalidated, then the county is going to make the argument that they're no longer subject to Section 5, and they'll go ahead and implement this plan. And the only way to challenge it will be for people to bring a lawsuit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but they will have the burden of proof. And these Section 2 lawsuits can go on for years, literally before a decision is reached. So it's really not an adequate remedy for Section 5.
This stuff is really interesting. So somewhere on Twitter this morning, I saw a link. I know I'm a Twitter lurker, huh? I saw a link to someone's analysis. It was like, well, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it sounds so old. Why would that matter? And someone was coming out and saying, right now, Texas is going to pass all those laws, the voter ID laws and things that have been blocked by the federal court. They're already just getting in line. They're just going to start throwing down all those laws. So talk about that a little bit. What's
Texas
next?
Got objections to its majority photo ID requirements, and also its House, Senate, and congressional plans were denied preclearance. The congressional plan and the Senate plan were denied preclearance because the court said that they had been enacted with a racially discriminatory purpose. So, you know, we're not talking about things that happened in 1965 or, you know, 150 years ago, but we're talking about ongoing discrimination against minority voters. And if we don't have Section 5, those things will go into effect. They will be implemented, and racial and language minorities will have the burden of trying to get them stopped by bringing suits. And these lawsuits can be very expensive. I mean, you can pay $100,000 in expert witness fees because you need expert witnesses who can draw plans, demographers. You need an expert witness who can is a statistician who can do a racial black voting analysis, and you might want to have historians or political scientists, and you have deposition expenses, and you have a lengthy trial. So the cost mounts, and the litigation goes forward. We've been involved in a case in Wyoming and also a similar case in South Carolina, the Wyoming case on behalf of American Indians, the Lexington, South Carolina case on behalf of African Americans. And those cases went on for 6 or 7 years before we even got a decision. So Section 2 and litigation by private plaintiffs is not an adequate response to the abolition of coverage under Section 5.
Because what I hear you saying is that if it takes 8 years to bring the lawsuit, what we're talking about is all of the people who will not get elected to office, all the people. It's like throwing those political systems in those places where the litigation happens. It's like throwing them into cement. And so it has to stop. No one can. I don't know. It literally slows down people's access to the political system. I mean, big picture.
Yeah, those changes are implemented. People are elected pursuant to these objectionable at-large plans or redistricting plans, and they stay in office. So it's not. I mean, Congress in 2005 and 2006, there were those who made the argument that Section 2 was an adequate remedy, and we didn't need Section 5. And Congress expressly rejected that argument and said that Section 2 was not an adequate remedy. It was time-consuming, it was expensive, and for all the reasons that I gave, that it's not an appropriate remedy, adequate remedy.
Okay, and we have just a few minutes left. We're with Lachlan McDonald, director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project, and we are looking at how the Supreme Court basically destroyed, demolished the Voting Rights Act yesterday, and how this is going to have an immediate impact on such things as voting rights, voter ID laws, especially in... Mr. McDonald, again, talk a little bit about the South. You know, I feel as though as we're looking at some of these cases, I can imagine that people inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. are like, oh, God, it's the South. Like this woman on Twitter was saying to me, it's like this country has an urban and rural divide on a national scale like that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, Congress expressly found that voting in the covered jurisdictions was racially polarized, and I mean, racially polarized voting isn't action by the state, but it's action by the people that live in the state. And the fact is that race continues to predict the outcome of elections. You can determine that if a person who is black runs in a majority white district, their chances of winning are very small because of not a substantial number of whites, if they have a choice between a white and a black voter, will vote for the black candidate. Almost all of the black elected officials were elected from majority black districts, most of which were created as a result of Section 5 and some as a result of Section 2. So, I mean, there's racial prejudice and bias in other places in the United States, that's for sure, and it's not just isolated in the South. I mean, we've been involved in a lot of cases on behalf of tribal members in the West, and there is no question that voting there is also racially polarized. I mean, we filed first lawsuit that we were involved in was in Bighorn County, Montana. Indians were about 40% of the population of the county, and had run for the county commission on numerous occasions but had never been elected to office. And we did a racial block voting analysis and showed that voting was racially polarized, that a significant number of white voters weren't going to vote for the Indian candidates. And after a number of years, we did get a favorable decision from the federal district court. He found that the at-large system diluted minority voting strength, that voting was significantly racially polarized, and implemented a system of district elections. And one of the districts, one of the three districts, was majority Indian. And at the very next election, an Indian was elected from that district. So the problem of racial block voting and bias and prejudice isn't isolated to the South, but it definitely continues to exist here.
Right, and we're also looking at attempts to require voter IDs in Ohio and Pennsylvania. We are running out of show, Lachlan McDonald, director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project. I have pulled up ACLU.org. And looking for the links to information about the Voting Rights Act. I see that you guys have a petition to bring this before Congress, which is pretty much what the Supreme Court says has to happen, and looking for another 5,000 people to sign that. Lachlan McDonald, what should everyday people be doing right now about the Voting Rights Act and what happened yesterday in the Supreme Court to guarantee that everyone has the right to vote?
Yeah, I think everyone should, assist Congress in taking appropriate action. You know, there's several things that Congress could do. It could rewrite the coverage formula, but it also could extend the existing bail-in provision. There is a provision under the Voting Rights Act that allows a court which has found a violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments, or 14th or 15th Amendments, to bail in a jurisdiction and subject it to Section 5. And there have been two non-covered states, Arkansas and New Mexico, who were subject to bail in. And there have been non-covered jurisdictions in California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Nebraska, New Mexico, New York, South Dakota, and Tennessee, which have been bailed in. So one of the things that Congress could do, and I think this would be very simple and straightforward, would be to expand the basis for bail-in, that the court found not simply a violation of the 14th or 15th Amendments, but a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, or some other provision of the Voting Rights Act, or a provision of some other federal law protecting voting rights. That would be a step in the right direction, although that would not cover all the jurisdictions that I think need to be covered. So I think people are talking about ways that the coverage formula can be rewritten so that it would be based on current needs and meet the concerns that were expressed by the majority. But people need to, you know, urge Congress to take some positive action.
All right. And more about that at ACLU.org. Look for the links around Voting Rights Act. Lachlan McDonald, director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project, thank you so much for being with us here on KBOO Community Radio today.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks. And this is it for our show. We're going to leave it there. Coming up is Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. And then at 10:15 on Flashpoint, a North American gets a tiny taste of what it's like to cross the new militarized border. Recovery Zone, Radio Zine coming up. Thanks for being with us, and stay tuned to KBOO.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 10 o'clock straight up. Coming up next, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia.
Do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you an active KBOO member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors. Applications are now being accepted for the 2013 election until midnight, June 28th. To apply, go to the kboo.fm homepage and click on KBOO Board of Directors Application.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 100.